Thank you for tuning in to CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly hour-long news report bringing you alternative and undercover current affairs coverage from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Andy Laidman.
And I'm Arman Rana. It's Thursday, August 23rd at 5 o'clock. We're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hakaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Today's show is jam-packed with some local politics. Wednesday, myself and Andy Laidman and Alex DeBoer conducted an interview with Ian Bushfield, who is the co-host of municipal politics podcast, The Canby Report. He also co-hosts Politicoast, a BC politics podcast, what we discussed with him is the basics of the local politics as the October 20th election fast approaches. His work centers around providing easily accessible political information to the average Vancouverite, while drawing on political surveys and open source information sharing to help track and graph the trajectory of the election.
And so that exciting interview is coming up, but first we are going to play an audio documentary that myself and Zoe Power, another News Collective member who's not here at the moment, have been working on for the last month. It premiered on your podcast app on August 28th, a couple days ago. And it's all about Vancouver's civic government, the way it is and how it came to be that way. Vancouver has a very unusual electoral system. It's an at-large system, meaning we don't have wards, which is unlike any other major Canadian city. So that's pretty interesting. And we are going to start out with that. So please stay tuned in. This is How We Got Here, Part 2, Vancouver Civic Government.
You're listening to Seeking Office, the Vancouver Municipal Election Podcast.
We were pretty clear on the election. When I talked to thousands and thousands of people, the referendum was pretty clear. Our mandate was pretty clear: reduce the size and cost of government.
This affects the way people are represented. The very structure of the government closest to the people, and the notion that we will make significant change to that structure without absolutely any public consultation, with no public consultation.
I represent 100,000 residents in Ward 27. That's 14 residential neighborhoods and 5 major business districts, and the workload is intense.
Councillor Kristen Wong-Tam strongly opposes the move to elect 25 instead of 47 councillors, saying it would make it harder for citizens to access their councillors.
I would imagine that the paperwork would probably spill to my chin. I would imagine that it would just take a lot longer. And I think it would just be grossly unfair to residents to not be able to access their local representatives.
That was Toronto Mayor John Tory and Toronto Councillor Kristen Wong-Tam responding to newly elected Ontario Premier Doug Ford. Ford, as you probably know, recently announced his intention to reduce the number of councillors in Toronto's municipal government from 47 to 25. John Tory and Kristen Wong-Tam have clear criticisms of this move to slash council. The lack of consultation by the provincial government is one of these, but another core issue, one that Kristen brings up, is that altering the relationship between councillors and constituents will impact the representation Torontonians have in their local government.
Yep, so if you believe Doug Ford, the proposed changes will improve local democracy by making Toronto's council cheaper to run and less bogged down in bureaucracy. But if you believe Ford's critics, the changes will actually hurt local democracy by distancing elected officials from the constituents who vote them in. So which one is it?
It's hard to say, but these are definitely questions that go beyond the City of Toronto. Vancouver, of course, has its own set of councillors and its own electoral system, which is different from Toronto, and in fact is different from most other Canadian cities.
That's true. I've been looking into this and learned, for example, that we don't have a ward system here in Vancouver. And as a result of that, our government also has some other unique characteristics when compared with most other Canadian cities.
Right. And so as we come closer to our civic election in October, I wonder if people know about these differences and how they affect the local government. Like, to start out, what is a ward system and what does it mean that we don't have one?
Right. And how many councillors do we have? Who do each of them represent? Who gets to vote them in? And how often does voting happen?
And which areas of the city do our representatives usually hail from?
And has our government always looked the way it does today?
It seems like ultimately, if we don't understand the way our own government works, we can't know if it's working for us. My name is Alex DeBoer.
My name is Zoe Power.
And you're listening to part two of How We Got Here, Vancouver Civic Government.
In the summer of 2013, I wanted to look at this common question in Vancouver politics, which is, what does it mean that Vancouver doesn't have a ward system?
That's Jenny Wakefield. He's a journalist and one of many people who's been interested in how Vancouver's unique electoral system affects our local government.
If you look at any other large city in Canada, pretty much, they have an electoral system where city councillors are elected out of wards, so neighborhoods, finite geographic areas instead of at large, which is how they do it in Vancouver, which means that the councillors are elected from the entire city, much like the mayor is everywhere. And that creates a lot of issues.
So before we get into Johnny's findings, I think we need to take a step back for a second. The ward system. Most Canadian cities have wards, but in Vancouver, instead we have what Johnny calls an at-large system, which means that all 10 of our elected councillors represent and are voted in by the entire city rather than by individual neighborhoods or regions.
Yeah, exactly. And this is today unique within the large cities of Canada. But if we look back over time, we realize that Vancouver hasn't always been so much of an outlier. In 1886, BC joins the Federation of Canada, and this lonely logging outpost on ancestral Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish land becomes known colonially as the City of Vancouver.
And the land that makes up what we call Vancouver today is unceded, meaning it was not given away in a treaty or won in a war.
Yeah, so all of this is going on. And then when Vancouver officially incorporates, the city gets its very first council, which is comprised of one mayor and 10 aldermen, or what we know today as councillors.
Oh, okay. Alderman means the same thing as councillor. So were there also alder ladies?
Goodness, no. Canadian women don't even get to vote in elections for another 30 years from then.
And people of color?
No. So in Canada at this point, as in many developed Western democracies around the world, participation and representation is very much restricted to white male citizens. So no Indigenous people are able to vote, and none of the many Chinese or Japanese migrants who were here could vote either. But from 1886, those who are allowed to vote in the city of Vancouver, they get to elect their aldermen based on a ward system.
Okay, that's interesting. So we did have wards in Vancouver.
Yeah, we had wards and we stuck with them for quite a while. But then in the 1920s, we moved to a system of proportional representation. Then we decided that was too complicated. And then we went back to an at-large system instead. And this is the point where Vancouver starts to become this weird local government exception in the Canadian political landscape.
Okay, so for now, I will note that Vancouver is weird.
Yeah, we're weird because we don't go back to a ward system like the other major Canadian cities. And then not going back to a ward system in turn makes us weird in a whole bunch of other ways as well.
Yeah, but is something this obscure just interesting to you and I and other civic politics nerds? Or does it affect the way the government works here in Vancouver? Like, does not having a ward system actually impact who gets elected?
on kind of a listless summer where I was like mowing lawns and like delivering papers and trying to figure out what the hell I was doing with my life. I spent about a couple weeks going, I can't remember how often it was, it might have been every day or every other day, to the Vancouver Archives in Vanier Park, which are very lovely. And they have in these accordion folders the nomination papers for councillors going back to, I think, 1960.
That's Jenny Wakefield, the journalist we heard from earlier. Back in that summer of 2013, Jenny was on a mission to find out what parts of Vancouver elected officials have actually come from in the city's at-large system.
What I wanted to do was look at where city councillors actually come from, because they're not elected specifically from neighborhoods, and they're are these sort of stereotypes that the left-leaning councillors would come from East Vancouver and that the real establishment types would come from, you know, Shaughnessy, Point Grey, places like that. And so I did some research looking at the nomination papers and old city directories and found out that that's sort of true, but obviously there are exceptions.
So with these decades-old nomination papers, Johnny found the home addresses for Vancouver's past councillors and mayors.
So I was able to put that into a Google map, essentially, with the help of my friend Paul Bucci. And we were able to make a map of where these people came from in the city.
And what's the what is the overarching arc of that trend? Did it fit the hypothesis that you went into it with?
Yeah, I mean, sort of. There are always exceptions, but you will see things like councillors from Cope would come from East Vancouver, so like Chinatown, Grandview, Woodland. So people like Ellen Woodsworth, Libby Davies, Jim Green. And then you would see that the NPA, perhaps stereotypically, had a bunch of people who lived around the West Point Grey golf course. There were just these very obvious clumps of people who were in a particular neighborhood. And then there were some neighborhoods, which is another issue with the ward system, that didn't have hardly any councillors elected from there. For example, Hastings on Rise, that sort of area. I'm just looking on the map here. I had, I think, one councillor in that period who I could find nomination papers for. Areas to the south typically did not have a lot of councillors elected from that area, so you would pick up on these really obvious trends.
Okay, so we have general divides between right-of-center and establishment candidates, most of whom have come from the wealthier suburbs of Vancouver, whereas left-leaning candidates have tended to reside in the less represented and often less affluent southern and eastern parts of the city. But does where councillors come from impact the way they act when they're in office? Like, who's to say that someone who resides in Shaughnessy will prioritize the interests of Shaughnessy residents above those of the other groups they represent in City Hall, because technically they represent the entire city, right?
Yeah, this question is obviously more subjective. You can't answer it just by looking at the ballot papers. But since Johnny had done a lot of research on the representative divide that wayward summer at the archives, I asked for his thoughts on the question.
I mean, you're obviously very influenced by who your neighbors are, where you live, what kind of problems you see every day. And if you're an at-large politician, I think you would have to kind of force yourself to go see constituents in other parts of the city and expose yourself to, you know, concerns that if you're representing people in a specific geographic area, you might be more attuned to. So, I mean, I think you could make arguments that a lot of the issues you see, like in East Vancouver, or, for example, the downtown east side, that, you know, maybe, for example, they didn't get the attention that they should have.
I'm homeless for a year and living in my tent. And, you know, it's not safe out there. We need housing. We need it today.
Welcome to the gentrification project by the City of Vancouver called Woodwards 2. So what do we want?
Housing.
And when do we want it?
Now.
What do we want?
So even though you might not be intentionally trying to privilege your area's issues, you're still going to be inherently impacted by whatever neighborhood you live and hang out in. That just makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And that's pretty much the whole justification for wards in the first place, right? Like, this is why other cities have consistently chosen to stick with the system, because they think it means that more folk get represented that way. But there's also more subtle ways that geography can play into who gets elected in an at-large system. A lot of studies in Vancouver have shown that the voting population is largely concentrated in the wealthy West Side neighbourhoods that Johnny mentioned earlier.
Right. So that means that even as a Hastings Sunrise resident, for example, who wants to run on Hastings Sunrise issues and get the people of Hastings Sunrise represented, you essentially have to appeal to, say, single-family homeowners by the Shaughnessy Golf Course, because their votes also count to elect you. And that wouldn't be the case if we had wards.
Yeah, exactly. So by not dividing up the city, you really wind up disproportionately representing certain groups of people. But this whole situation where our candidates wind up having to appeal to voters all over the city, not just voters from their own area, is actually the cause of another super weird quirk of our municipal politics.
Oh no, Vancouver is weird in even more ways. I'm shocked.
Vancouver is weird in all of the ways.
Now projecting a liberal, the Conservatives will the Green Party, Justin Trudeau, position that reduces the NDP to third party status.
You know how federally the parties you always hear about are the Liberals and the Conservatives and the NDP and so on, but then locally we have the NPA and COPE and Vision Vancouver and all of these other parties?
Yeah.
That's weird. That's weird because other provinces in Canada don't really have parties at the local level. In Ontario, where Doug Ford wants to cut all of those councillors, political parties are actually banned in local politics. So everyone who gets elected there does so as an independent. And this ties into the whole question about wards or not wards, because if you're running as a local candidate and you're doing so without a ward system, then you have to get your message out across the entire city, which is hard.
You have to remember that Vancouver is an outlier in this case with a consistent party system since the 1930s.
That's Jack Lucas, a political science professor at the University of Calgary. He's a bit of an expert on the history of Vancouver's civic government.
So what happened in the other cities was that
Jack narrates the rise and fall of Canadian political parties and explains that other provinces got rid of them because of the perception parties were too powerful or just not needed at the local level.
It has to do with the way people really think about what municipal politics is all about. And there's this long-standing and deeply held view that municipal politics just isn't about ideology. It's the classic quote that there's no right-wing or left-wing way to fill a pothole or pave a road. There's no conservative or liberal way to build a bridge. On the other side of the debate, it gives voters a much easier time deciding who they're going to vote for, particularly in at-large systems where they have lots of votes to cast. And parties are also defended just by rejecting the premise of the argument of the nonpartisans that there's nothing ideological about city politics. So a lot of people say, well, it's very obvious that city politics is ideological in character.
So parties might actually be super relevant in municipal politics, because local politics aren't necessarily apolitical. And that's what we're seeing in our election this year. I mean, there's a notable amount of politics and ideology involved in something like the housing crisis. For example, should we have social housing or just increase supply?
Yeah, totally. There's for sure politics in bike lanes.
Yeah, or how to solve the opioid crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And having parties listed next to names on the ballot obviously helps voters know where candidates stand on issues like these, because they can more easily learn the values of, say, a handful of parties than 100 individual candidates.
Yeah, that is true. Although one of the things that critics of the at-large system always say is that if we did split the city up into wards, so if each voter only had to vote on candidates within their neighbourhood, then there wouldn't even be so many dang names on the ballot paper. Like, at the last election, we actually had 149 names listed on the ballot, which is probably pretty hard for voters to sort through, even with a party system.
Yeah, that's probably true. And even besides voting, I have to wonder what else not having a ward system means for Vancouver. Because not only is our electoral system weird, our 2018 civic election also seems pretty weird. In this election, we've seen more political parties spring up, and many of these have found a place in the middle of the political spectrum. This is something I asked Jack Lucas about.
Sure. So I'll tell you a little about a classic political science theory of voting, which is called median voter theory, which is the idea that, assuming lots of other things that we won't talk about are in place, a candidate is going to try to put together a platform that represents the median voter in their constituency, the person who represents the middle of the road position. And the reason for that is because if you can capture that median position, then you and the people who are closest to you from both the right and the left will vote for you. And since there are a lot of people in the middle, you will do well. So that's median voter theory in a very, very small nutshell, like a pistachio shell. Now, the reason this matters for Vancouver is because if you have a ward, then what you're trying to target, assuming median voter theory is true, what you're trying to target is the median voter in that ward. Now, I don't want to go too far down the road of saying median voter theory explains everything there is to explain in the world, but it does suggest that in an at-large system like Vancouver, you're going to have that pressure, particularly for parties that want to be in power as opposed to shape the debate. If they're pursuing power, then there is always that pressure.
Me personally, it's the right time for me.
The time to call it quits. After 10 years as mayor of Vancouver, Gregor Robertson says he won't run again in this fall's municipal election.
Is there anything about this election and its candidates and what we're seeing so far that seems at all unusual or different from other elections in previous years?
Right, the rise of the independent.
Not only without a majority, I mean, it seems pretty likely there may not be a majority on council, but there could be as many as, you know, four or five different affiliations on there,
right.
Maybe even more, I don't know.
That's exactly it. We've never really had that situation before.
Ever? Yeah. I mean,
this is a unique election.
Yeah.
Now, you have to...
It's hope and a plan, and that is what we are offering.
Say yes.
Say yes.
Say yes.
Say yes.
To taking good ideas.
Say yes to not playing politics.
Say yes. Yes
to bringing people together.
So, median voter theory seems like a reasonable explanation for the rise we're seeing in centrist and self-described centrist parties in this civic election.
Yeah, I found this really interesting. I mean, the theory definitely fits with what we talked about in the last installment about Vision emerging as a moderate version of the more left-leaning Cope.
And now Yes Vancouver is sort of like a more moderate version of the NPA, our most right-wing civic party.
Yeah, and Pro Vancouver, that other new party, also identifies as something more toward the middle.
And Jack sees this trend towards centrism as a potential indicator of something more.
In a way, this also reminds me of the period when political parties kind of died off in other Western Canadian cities. What happened was that it wasn't that they just went away. It was more that they kept changing their names, and there were new parties popping up at every single election, and then those parties would go away, and a new party would emerge. And it was hard for voters to tell which parties were even related to which other parties in the past, and it all kind of slowly disintegrated.
Wow, so looking at patterns in history is actually really cool and makes me realize that just because things are the way they are now, that doesn't mean that they were always that way.
And doesn't mean they'll always stay that way either.
Yeah, and so if we are on the verge of some sort of significant electoral change, we have to think about what that might look like. And obviously we've been talking a lot about wards and what they would look like, but there's also PR as an option.
Yeah, and that's an option we're voting on at the provincial level this October, too.
Right, so that change at the provincial level could affect our local government.
And to me, what makes these changes really interesting is that getting rid of our at-large system and adopting wards, or PR, or whatever else it might be, is ultimately about much more than who ends up getting elected. It's also about what kinds of representation we prioritize when it comes to local government.
In some ways, it has to do with making a decision about the kinds of communities and the forms of representation that are most important. With a ward system, the assumption is that what's most important is is geography, right? That distinct parts of the city get representation.
Everyone knows Shaughnessy Homes.
Kitsilano defines multicultural. There are every type here.
When I think of Vancouver's Chinatown, I picture open markets, paper lanterns.
The alley in Vancouver's Point Grey neighborhood got very heated on Sunday.
And with an at-large system, it has more to do with the idea that there are these city-wide communities, maybe ideological communities or class or whatever it might be.
Here, march with other gays, lesbians, queers throughout the Lower Mainland.
Tax the rich to house the poor! Tax the rich!
And that the most important priority is to represent those pan, you know, citywide voices rather than specific geographic communities.
Right. So, I mean, it seems like, to me, the least democratic electoral system is what we have now in Vancouver with no wards and no proportional representation. And then slightly more democratic would be having wards that were divided along sort of community lines, though populations are shifting. You know, there's a lot of gentrification and stuff happening in the city. And that ultimately the most democratic would probably be to just have an at-large system that has proportional representation. But I guess that's a subjective takeaway.
Well, you know, we get into ever deeper waters here about what a more or less democratic system really looks like and what kinds of aspects of democratic system we should be prioritizing. But it is certainly true that a small majority of voters in Vancouver, given the current system, has the potential to determine an overwhelming majority of city council seats because of the slightly unusual at-large majoritarian system that the city of Vancouver has. But I think what you're noticing is that there are these clear trade-offs, and there's no system that captures all of the things we want to take out of an electoral system, you know, without any of the drawbacks.
Well, here we are at the end of a long and confusing story with no clear answer.
Yeah, I'm starting to learn that's sort of how politics is. One thing we've learned, though, is that the party system and the at-large system do kind of perpetuate each other, because appealing to the entire city takes resources that only a party can really provide.
Right, and since you're just one of over 100 names on the ballot, it's hard for you to reach the whole electorate, aka the whole city, unless you're with a party that's known and has a clear message.
Yeah, without party affiliation, people don't know what you stand for unless they've really done their homework. And that's something most people don't do.
And in line with that, it's also true we haven't had an independent elected to council in the last 30 years. But I wonder if this might be changing. If, in fact, we are on the cusp of joining the rest of Canadian cities by getting rid of our civic political parties and perhaps adopting wards or PR, could this be the rise of the independent?
Yeah, I wonder. Plus, with the party landscape changing and so few incumbents running, this year certainly gives them a better chance. Plus, if there are these obvious downsides to the system we do have, like that we're not representing the whole city equally, or that we keep voting in people who live next to golf courses, maybe the conditions are right for a broader change. So you didn't sound like I'm in a cave.
Ooh. All right, this is me talking. This is a test for me talking. Thank you for listening. How We Got Here, Part 2, Vancouver's Civic Government, was made by me, Alex DeBoer, and Zoe Power.
Why wouldn't that us just...
Because it's in a thing. Because Audacity is garbage.
Okay, but we are recording and we can move it. Okay, great.
Research by Zoe Power.
Jack's talking.
Editing by me, Alex DeBoer. Yeah. Music by Artem Bemba.
Looks good.
Yeah, look, my waves are even bigger than your waves.
Yeah.
No, they're about
also featuring a live performance of the Apollo Ghost album Easting Sunrise by Chris Arific. Am I going to say wow?
I don't know. Do you want to listen to the bit before?
Other sounds from freesounds.org. No.
I can be the bit before.
No, it's okay.
In all the other cities in Canada.
Wow. Special thanks to Jack Lucas, Johnny Wakefield, Madeline Taylor, and the entire news collective at CITR 101.9 FM.
That's really weird.
I'm laughing. It's like a generous offering to you.
Okay.
All right, you're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. You just heard an audio doc made for our podcast Seeking Office. That was called Vancouver Civic Government, and it was part two of the series How We Got Here. You can check it out on any podcast app by searching Seeking Office if you want to download it or share it with friends. We're going to take a very short break and then come back with an interview we did with a political analyst,
commentator,
very informed citizen, and podcaster Ian Bushfield. So stay tuned.
CITR Radio 101.9 FM and Discorder Magazine present
The Victory Square Block Party 2018.
We're back with our annual free all-day party to bring summer to a close. Happening on Sunday, September 2nd from 1 to 9 p.m. in Victory Square Park at the corner of Cambie and Hastings. With performances by La Casquivana, Princess Apparently, Sorry Edith, Future Star, Mama Rude Gal, Club Sofa, Yep, and Devours. Plus an ice cream truck on site and a raffle for kick butt local prizes.
And we're back. Thanks for tuning in to CITR 101.9 FM. We're just going to conclude our show here with an interview that myself and Alex DeBoer did yesterday with Ian Bushfield. As we previously mentioned, Ian is the co-host of two municipal politics podcasts, and he really focuses on trying to bring political information to the average citizen. One of the ways he does that is he centers his work around providing very accessible information through drawing on political surveys and open source documents to help graph and track the trajectory of the election. One such tool, and the reason we got really intrigued to talk to him, is a graph that he made placing political parties along three axes, which measure from left to right, economics, social issues, and urbanists versus conservationists. He placed those political parties from information he gathered actually from the general public and not just from political experts or from the parties themselves. So that way that people can kind of see where other members of the public would place these parties. He also created a document that details all the candidates running in not only Vancouver's municipal election, but across the Lower Mainland. And that's accessible to all members of the public to edit. So here's the interview. So first off, can you just tell us a bit about yourself and why you know so much about Vancouver municipal election?
It's weird. I don't know how I sort of came across it. I have always kind of been a political nerd. So in high school and undergrad, I was following politics, but I never actually studied political science. I did engineering physics as an undergrad, and then I came out to Vancouver to do physics at SFU. But when I was in undergrad, for example, I got involved in Linda Duncan's campaign in Edmonton and helped get her elected in 2008. And so I got involved sort of in politics here, not really with any active campaigns, but just following it and talking to friends about it. And so it's just that, like, spending a lot of time on the internet, just talking to people, and that's where it all really comes from for me.
Well, although you may not be formally trained as a political scientist or analyst, you have done a lot of work graphing and keeping spreadsheets of the 2018 municipal elections. If you could, in, say, 2 minutes, would it be possible to give an overview of specifically Vancouver's 2018 municipal election?
Sure. One of the first things I did just before we were launching Cambie Report, and it wasn't officially a strategy to build awareness for the podcast that we were launching, but it worked out that way, is I developed this Google sheet of just keeping track of who said they were running for what party. Because after Gregor Robertson, the current mayor, said he's not running again, and a number of city councilors said they're not running again either, there was this kind of void. And I guess politics abhors a vacuum, and people started coming forward from the left and the right, and it got really hard to just keep up. And I think even journalists were having trouble because you had new parties cropping up and people jumping ship from the NPA or jumping from Vision. And so I just started going, all right, here's someone who said on Twitter they're seeking this nomination. Let's put them on a sheet. Let's make that public. And then I even made it publicly editable so that other people could help keep up with that. And luckily, no one's trashed it yet. So good work, Twitter. And from there, you know, we launched the podcast, and a couple weeks ago, we developed this like little survey to help plot where all the Vancouver political parties are, and just getting people to submit their own thoughts on, you know, where is this Coalition Vancouver Wei Young's party? Turns out everyone thinks they're pretty far right relative to Vancouver. And we got this interesting line graph. So politics gets usually talked about in the left-right spectrum, but that gets a bit simplistic when, you know, someone might be really progressive on social issues, but really free market oriented, and that isn't clear left or right. But we are also talking about, in Vancouver, there's this housing axis almost, this how do we think about cities? Should it be a more urban city, or should it be more like status quo, a more like conservationist? Because some people think the older elements of COPE are very, you know, let's keep Vancouver for Vancouverites. And then there's like one city that's like, let's densify, but in a social justice way. And then there's Yes Vancouver that's just like, let's tear down the, you know, regulations and let developers go crazy. And I'm caricaturing all of them, but so you get this left-right spectrum on economics and social policy, where on the left you have COPE, one city, sort of moving to the center, you get Vision and the Greens, and moving to the right you have Yes Vancouver, NPA, Pro Vancouver, and Coalition Vancouver. I might be missing one. I think there's a Vancouver First now. I don't know where they fit. Parties are popping up too quick. There is.
Is there a Vancouver First?
Yeah. What? A guy named Fred Harding is running for mayor. He's like a former fire chief or something.
Isn't that in Burnaby?
No, that's Mike Hurley. Yeah, it's really hard to keep up with this, right? So that's where they all kind of sit on the left-right spectrum. But then you look at these municipal issues, and Yes Vancouver's more on the, you know, redevelop, open up Dunbar, say, to density. One city agrees but wants it to be more co-op housing or social and more in that kind of approach, non-market housing. Vision's kind of the status quo, but in a progressive way. You also have Kennedy Stewart and Shauna Sylvester, who are both running for mayor as independents. Everyone's kind of putting them in the same area, but I think Shauna's trying to be a broad tent centrist, whereas Kennedy is moving more to the left and really trying to be like the NDP candidate. And then also for council, the other interesting thing is there's a ton of independents running. So you have people like Adrian Crook, who was talking about running with Yes Vancouver, and he's a popular blogger for Five Kids, One Condo, really talking about, you know, how do we make urban life work? And so he's got a decent following. Sarah Blythe, a overdose activist and past Vision Park Board trustee, is now running as an independent. Wade Grant, who was previously with the ones Yes Vancouver slate, is also running as an independent. Who else is out there? Rob McDonnell, I think, if I have his name right, he was with the NPA and now is independent. And so you have this like large number of independents as well, which often happens in Vancouver, but usually because it's so hard for independents to get elected, they're usually fringe sort of people just trying to bring the ideas forward. But a lot of these people seem like they have a good chance, especially at the mayor level. So with the new campaign finance laws, where corporations and unions can't give money to political parties and individuals have a limit, it maybe opens it up for anyone to take it.
Right. So you identified a lot of unique factors in this 2018 civic election. So what are all the forces that have created this difference? You said the new campaign finance laws, Gregor Robertson leaving office, Vision's been in power for 10 years. What else is there?
I think there's a real dissatisfaction with the housing crisis. Like, it reached such a point where everyone's very tense, and especially younger people, young professionals, people with a bit of money, maybe people who are lower income who are being pushed out, older people who perhaps have a home but are now seeing a bunch of the new taxes that the provincial government's coming on. They might be a bit more reticent to take up a municipal party that wants to radically rezone the city. And you have all these forces at play, and people are really just trying to figure out, you know, has vision done enough? And I think a lot of people are saying no, but the question is, what should we do instead?
And so what should people look for in distinguishing between the political parties? Because everyone says they're going to fix the housing crisis, right? So what specifically should voters be looking for when they're making their decisions?
It's tough to say right now, because prior to Labor Day, most of the parties are just trying to get themselves into a place where they're ready to run. So we don't actually know what most of these parties are going to do if they become mayor or council. They're really just talking about value statements. I saw Hector Bremner do a little one-minute speech one time where he just talked about the value of love and, like, caring about other citizens. And, you know, that's great, and that's important to sort of hear empathy from our politicians. But I think the policies will start to follow after Labor Day, because the election's not till October 20th, and historically election campaigns at the municipal level are like 30 days. So I think people need to listen, think critically about all the proposals being brought forward. There are going to be a lot of really wonky things. I know one city has already talked about a land value tax, which to most people, that means nothing. But essentially what they're trying to do is they're saying, when we develop, say, the SkyTrain line out to UBC, or even if it only goes to Broadway or Arbutus, they want to build a bunch of condos around those. But rather than just have developers kind of capitalize on the speculation around there, let's add a little tax to that to sort of slow down the speculation, but also use that extra money. And they think they could get a lot of money from this to fund further transit and fund further civic services. But on the flip side, if you put too many taxes, you kind of drive down the desire to build. And so does it counteract? And I'm not saying it's a good or bad policy. A lot of economists like it, and a lot of people even on the left like it as a good way to sort of get some social good out of what would otherwise be seen as this rampant gentrification. Then we also have to remember that there's more than just housing happening in the city. We're in the midst of a opioid crisis and epidemic in the downtown east side and across the city. Bike lanes are always contentious. You know, and whatever else people care about. I mean, there's seniors issues, there's small business issues. What people, I think, forget is that municipal governments are actually the most important. They affect our everyday life. Right now, Trudeau is, like, arguing a trade deal with the U.S. None of us will see the effects of that very quickly, maybe over the long term. But the things the city council can do affect whether your garbage gets picked up. They affect whether you have clean drinking water. Right now, there's agitation that Vancouver schools, some of them still have lead pipes. If that's a big issue, pay attention to your school board election, because we haven't even talked about that. And there's park board, which they have power over our parks. And if you care about cetaceans or if you care about the aquarium, that's a big contentious issue out there. And
yeah, let's stop for a minute and talk about that. So most people are aware in this election they're voting on a mayor and they're voting on a city council. But as you mentioned, there's also the park board and the school board. Can you tell listeners who might not know a lot about those bodies of the local government what each does?
Sure. So Vancouver's unique in that it's the only place, as far as I know, in North America that has a park board. And this is an elected body that oversees all of the parks in the city. And it was created when Vancouver created Stanley Park as a way to protect it. I mean, it was stolen Indigenous land, and that's problematic, but the park board is actually working now to work on reconciliation as a city council. And so the park board is really responsible for the beaches, the services in our parks, making sure litter gets picked up and the grass gets cut, but also, you know, should the bathrooms be trans accessible is something they've talked about as well. And some of these kind of issues come up through there. So park board, I think, gets very forgotten about, but it's a very, you know, unique situation we have. School board obviously affects every parent very directly. These are the trustees who are tasked with managing the budget and deciding sort of where to allocate funds within their powers. So they oversee hiring of teachers to some extent and deciding how many and that kind of thing. Policies within the schools. So Vancouver's been really progressive at bringing in anti-homophobic bullying policies, and some of these have been very good things, in my opinion, to see. And really just making sure that, you know, our schools are safe. I talked about the water issue, but also seismic upgrading is a big thing. A lot of our older schools are not earthquake safe, which is terrifying to think about. children live there or go there. So those kind of issues are what school board deals with. And in the past, Vancouver school board's been very confrontational with the previous Liberal government because it was a more sort of vision center-left school board, and they refused to pass a austerity budget, essentially. They said, we can't make more cuts without really damaging the education system, and so the previous government fired them. A lot of those people aren't with the school board anymore. They've kind of moved on, but, you know, school board is really important, and so is park board.
Right, and so what about city council? That might seem more obvious, but what is the role, what are the role of city councilors and also the mayor?
So, I mean, as far as I understand, and I'm likely to get something wrong as well as in the previous ones, and people can correct me, the mayor is really just first among equals. They're like a figurehead. So we always think of the premier and prime minister as like a very powerful, like they head the executive branch of those governments. The mayor really doesn't have additional powers besides like one vote on council. They have a lot of media presence, and that's an important thing for a city like Vancouver that's trying to position itself as a world-class city. But otherwise, you can think of the mayor as like a councillor with a fancy title. Now, city council decides all the other policies that affect the city, how services are delivered. The mayor actually also sits on the TransLink Council and helps work with, and I believe appoints a couple people to that. And so they decide regional transit issues. They also deal with, you know, mundane things like garbage pickup, water, these things that we forget about because when they work well, we don't need to think about them. But then they also look at, you know, where should the city go? So they look at longer things like zoning. They deal with a lot of permit applications about building new towers. You know, should we allow new towers in West Falls or East Falls Creek? And the previous council just approved a big redevelopment plan for sort of that area between Science World and BC Place, which is a lot of empty land right now that's been meaning to be developed for 30 years. So the decisions on how that gets developed all go through city council, often through subcommittees. So if you as an engaged citizen really want to have a voice, it's often important to go to those kind of meetings, those planning meetings, rather than just show up at council, because by the time something's there, it's really just, you know, up or down vote.
Right, and how can people get involved in those subcommittees?
I think you can find a lot of information just through the city's website. They really try to make sure that people can get there. They're not trying to do things behind closed doors. When you actually speak to the people who are involved in politics, even the ones who you ideologically disagree with, they all are there for a good reason. They all believe in municipal politics and building a better Vancouver. We disagree on how to get there, but they all want to make sure that this Vancouver is one that everyone is happy with. So, you know, even email the councillor, someone like George Affleck, who's an outgoing councillor who I probably don't agree with on many policies, he's very approachable. He'll tweet you back.
Yeah. It would be great to talk a little bit more about this graph you made, which you've already touched on, and the graph, which initially confused us a bit because it has three axes, mm-hmm. but they're color-coded,
it's
so it's
really hard
two
to,
at once.
Really hard to plot, right?
Yeah, but I thought that once I understood it, I thought that was clever. So you have, as you mentioned, economic issues, left to right, and then you have social issues, left to right. Those are kind of traditional ways of measuring where someone stands politically. And then you have this third category, which is urbanist, conservationist, which, like you said, is how much someone wants to sort of densify and improve transit and add bike lanes and make a city more of a city, more urban in the sense of the word. And conversely, on the other side, how much someone wants to preserve like the character of neighborhoods and, in this case, in Vancouver, probably single-family zoning. Before we dissect this a bit more, could you tell us about your methodology, how you put this together?
Yeah, it really spawned out of my discussions with Stuart Prest, who is a political scientist. He really liked this idea of having a third axis to really explore the differences, because he thought, you know, we kind of understand the left-right economic social stuff, but political parties are really trying to position themselves on where they stand on density and housing and bike lanes and things like that. And the easiest example is look at the difference between COPE and One City. In terms of social justice, social policies, they're all on board with the same things. Even on economic policies, they both tend to be pretty left, pretty favoring government over market solutions. But then you look at, you know, what's their approach to rezoning the city? And there's this sense, I think, especially among older members of older members of COPE that they're a bit more conservative in a sort of small C way, like a skepticism of developers, because that was often seen as gentrification and, you know, displacing east side of Vancouver, whereas One City has actively talked about redeveloping the city from Belmont or boundary to Belmont and really trying to encourage big rezoning projects to replace single-family homes with denser areas, maybe rentals, for example, or social housing mixes and those kind of things. And that tension is one of the like key, most interesting things, I think, of this election. And then on the other side, you have like Coalition Vancouver, who is very much a single-family home party. They hate bike lanes. They've been very clear about that. Wei Young stood on one and said, we'll rip this one out in front of the hospital, and then every other one we put in, we need to tear one out. And also really kind of preserve the wealth, I guess, of the single-family home neighborhoods versus, yes, Vancouver, who's really gone the other way and said, I mean, when Hector Bremner was on council, or he is on council, but he brought forward a motion to do a big rezoning of the west side of Vancouver.
Sorry, just going back to your methodology, you mentioned earlier that you relied on survey information. Why did you choose to do that instead of consulting experts?
I was really curious to get the sense of what people who were following Vancouver politics thought. And so the approach I did was I created a Google form, and I put that onto Twitter and had a lot of people retweeted and end up getting about 70 to 80 responses. And it's a very self-selected sample, and I'll admit that, right? It's not a methodologically sound. I'm not going to publish this in any academic journal, but it was more just like a fun exercise to try to see what people who were following the conversation thought. And it was actually pretty consistent. Some of the parties had bigger error bars, as it were. I think a lot of people moved COPE around on some of the axes, and NPA was also kind of unsure on some of the spots. But, you know, everyone put Coalition Vancouver as a very right-wing social and a very right-wing economic and even a very conservationist, urbanist kind of party. And One City was the exact opposite. And Vision, for example, was similarly like center-left on the main things, but there's some uncertainty elsewhere. And that was interesting to see. And I just wanted to see if that would engage people a little bit more and start more conversations too.
Yeah, it's interesting because then also your spreadsheet keeping track of the municipal candidates is open as well. So your approach to keeping track of this election is very participatory.
Yeah, and I have always just personally had that as a value of this like democratic idea that if people get engaged, democracy works better. And so it's been reassuring to see these things not get broken by trolls. Like I said, I made the spreadsheet open so people could add to it. Mainly that was when people started wanting to build ones for Burnaby and other municipalities, and I thought that was a great idea. But I said, well, why don't we just like combine efforts? I'll give you access. And then I went, well, why don't I just give everyone access and just add tabs for all the cities? And it's sort of grown. So if you're in New West or if you're in Port Coquitlam, there are tabs for you on that spreadsheet, and you can sort of see who is listed as running. Now, some municipalities have only one or two because their elections don't really get started until 2 weeks before.
Yeah, there's a lot to keep track of. Something that Andy touched on before that I wanted to ask about as well is this idea that in terms of like optics and the messaging that's being sent out by parties, everyone is saying we're progressive, we're center, at least everyone is saying they're socially center or left, except for COPE, who says they're straight up left, and even the MPA says they're
progressive. Well, and they're all grassroots too, right?
Yeah, it's indeed.
Grassroots progressive campaigns.
Yes, all of those, and all are able to solve the housing crisis. So I think that it's very confusing for voters who, if you just kind of glance at who's running, it looks like everyone's offering the same thing. So in terms of actually deciphering, you would say then, related to the graph you made, we can look at the specific ways in which people would address the housing crisis and then also their urbanist conservationist positioning?
Yeah, that's one way. I mean, one of the first questions I asked on that survey is, you know, where do you position yourself? And we realized the respondents were I don't think we asked race, but I'm just going to assume a white male 37-year-old urban planner who's slightly center-left. And we have met a couple of those, but that kind of ability to say, you know, what are my values on these issues? I can plot myself. And this is something we've seen done more professionally at federal and provincial levels by like Vote Compass, where you answer a bunch of questions and it plots you on this graph, and then you can see where the other parties sit near you. And that's a good sort of first approximation, I think, because, you know, if you see that these three parties are in your region, then you can investigate them further and maybe spend a little less time investigating the people who are diametrically opposed to your values. And I think one of the other things that we haven't even touched on is with all of these parties, like, you do get to vote for 10 councillors, so you don't have to vote just down one party. A lot of on the more left side went through this process where the big union organization, the Vancouver District and Labour Council, set out to get them all in agreement that they wouldn't overcompete with each other. And ultimately, they, I think, got them down to running 12 candidates for 10 spots, which I guess is better than what's starting to happen on the other side, where the NPA, I think, is running 9 candidates. Coalition Vancouver says they're going to run like 7, I think. Pro Vancouver, who's somewhere in the anti-developer space, want to run another 5. Yes, Vancouver's put out a slate of 5. And so people over there, I guess, are spoiled for choice, depending on where you fit on those ideas. But we're going to have very big ballots. And for the first time in a while, they're going to be randomized. So it's going to be very hard to find your candidates, too.
Yeah, that's a good point. So people who are voting more on the right socially and economically will have more choices and could perhaps vote entirely with one party. But on the left, because of this Labour and District Council agreement, that won't be so much the case. But then, and we'll definitely link to your graph because I think this is really helpful. You know, you brought up a really interesting point that people can vote for different candidates based on different qualities. So it's not everyone's in one group. There are these different groups because of these different axes.
Yeah, and that's something I think people have always kind of done in Vancouver is picked and choose. And a lot of people don't actually fill out their ballot. And it's actually valuable to sometimes do that because if you're voting for people who you only kind of like, they sometimes end up getting more votes than the people you like. And so there's this mathematical concept called plumping your ballots where some people only vote for like 3 or 4 people that they're like, I really want them to win. And there's a bunch of people who, you know, they'd be fine. But it's the difficulties with a system where, you know, it's the first 10 past the post.
And you've kind of touched on this right at the beginning, but I wanted to know, from following this election and hosting your podcast, which stands out to you that's different about this election in comparison to previous years?
Really early when we started the podcast, one of our first interviews was Frances Beulah, and she's a journalist, or was a journalist for the Vancouver Sun, and she's covered the city for 20 or 30 years or more. She knows the politics here inside and out. And even then, I think this was back in like May or June, she was like, this is an election like one I've never seen in this city. Like, everything about it is bizarre and wild. There was so much happening then. Like, at one point, we were talking about, like, oh, is Vision walking away from the VDLC because they think they can go it alone? And then the Greens at some point decided just to run more candidates, and everyone else went, I guess that's okay. And there's all these, like, little, you know, kind of trivial in the scheme of things, twists and turns, but for following it, it's just like, what's going on? But I think the big thing that's different and that might be a game changer is just how many independents are coming forward. And that thing with just their ability to fundraise on an equal footing with the established parties. Now, Vision has a giant war chest, so that's why I would never count them out. But people like Kennedy Stewart are posting their fundraising data regularly and showing that he's raising a lot of money. He could do really well. But he's also probably competing with Shauna Sylvester and Ian Campbell. Cope's not running a mayoral candidate, but they might have, and then they would have also been competing for the same votes. So it's just really hard to know, but we may have a mayor elected with 25% of the vote.
Indeed. So besides looking at your graph for where candidates and parties stand on social, economic, and then urbanist versus conservationist issues, are there certain sort of things voters should look out for, like, that will kind of clue them into how parties are different?
It all depends on how much time you have. I mean, mm-hmm. The best situation would be to go back and listen to every episode of Canby Report and every episode of Seeking Office. You've interviewed a number of the candidates, and we're planning to interview all the mayoral candidates and representatives from each of the party in the next couple of weeks and slowly release those over the election. So there will be the content out there. There's also going to be forums and debates. I think I'm hosting one in a couple of weeks. It's a housing forum. That's a $20 ticket fee, but there will be other ones that are free and accessible. If you can get out to one of those, you can kind of start to hear what people are saying. And the other thing I think that's always really good to look for is who's actually hitting the pavement and you know, out there door knocking and working the hardest and has the most volunteers, because that really shows, at least for me, some commitment to the sort of democratic spirit of getting out there and not just sort of relying on guaranteed votes, but actually trying to build a movement, whether that's, you know, for the left or the right. I think, yes, Vancouver is doing that. I think one city is doing that. I think Gene Swanson has done that and is doing that still. So watching these different parties move forward, and of course the Greens have their movement. So someone who puts in the time before the election is probably going to put in the time after the election. And I'd rather have 10 committed, engaged councillors, even if I only agree with three of them, than, you know, a council where everyone's kind of sitting on their hands and just not really wanting to be there. I don't think anyone who's running would be that, but look who's working the hardest.
And do you have to be on Twitter to know what's going on in this election, in addition to what you said?
I think it's probably unhelpful to be on Twitter.
Whoa.
It gets very echo chambery, and there's like different elements to that. There's a very anti-developer, everything's a scam, and it's a very kind of negative space side. And then there's this also very like, we need more urbanism, that gets very intense about that. And if you sort of question them, if you question anyone on Twitter, it can get very toxic, right? And so I think people get too hung up on the social media conversation and not actually talking to people. That's why I really like doing the podcast, because we both get to talk to people in situations like this. So I would say don't get on Twitter unless, you know, you're already on it and having fun there. Just go out to a couple forums and debates and meet some people.
All right. Well, thank you for chatting with us, Ian.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you both for having me, and I hope everyone checks out both our podcasts.
So do we.
Yeah.
Hello, and you're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We're running a bit late. It's 8 minutes after the hour. Shocking, because normally on community radio, we are just right on time, and we just end precisely on time as well. That was an interview that myself and Andy, who's here, did with Ian Bushfield, who is a co-host of the Canby Report and also Politicoast podcast on BC Politics. So, you know, are we rivals?
No, we're frenemies.
No, we're frenemies.
Yeah,
No, we're friends, I think. We support each other.
Collaborators.
We're collaborators. Yeah, so check out the Canby Report if you have not already.
Also check out Seeking Office, though, if you have not already.
Oh. That's true.
Leave a review, I guess. And
give us five stars.
Give us five stars. There you go.
Subscribe. Give us five stars, please. Also, today I did an interview on Vancouver is Awesome, their podcast. So that will be coming out on Monday. So listen to that and hear me talk.
And
So many plugs. So collaborative.
Was I articulate? Was I clumsy? Was I awkward? Who knows? Find
Shout out.
Out
to Roniel, yeah.
Find out. It might be embarrassing. Also, what's happening this weekend, Andy?
There's Victory Square Block Party,
what's
Alex.
What's that? That sounds like fun.
Oh, my goodness. It is going to be so fun. It's in Victory Square, so in case you forget where it is, just think of the name. It is downtown.
Downtown?
Right.
Cool.
Yeah. Okay. It is.
Got it.
There's going to be live bands. There's going to be an ice cream truck. Me and Alex are going to be there. So you can come chat with us about local politics.
You and Alex? Me?
Yeah, you.
Me?
Cool. You'll be there, right?
Okay. Yeah, we will be there. And we'll be interviewing some bands. Ola, will you be there?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
So we'll
find my hand. I don't know. But I will try to be there. I hear it's a fun time. There's bands like, you know, Future Star and Sorry Edith and
Princess Apparently.
There we go.
Devours.
There we go. So,
such
like,
great bands.
If any of those names sound good, you should probably get
And if
down
they
there.
Don't, yeah. still.
Yeah.
It is the last block party of summer. So if you're on the fence, just think about that. We're headed into some cold winter months.
Some rain. And honestly, let's be real for a second. It's like a fashion show. Like, people get on their trendiest clothes. It's like the end of summer.
I see.
Socialite thing to do. No one agrees with me.
I've
I mean, sure. I for sure will be dressing up. So cool.
Yeah,
wearing a gown. Wear your flowery summer shirt and those nice, nice shorts, short shorts.
Outfits.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wait, under the gown?
Wait, what? I was thinking completely different.
Isn't our banter funny?
It's not funny at all. It's very bad. Kind of, I just heard everybody just tune out off of us. CITR 101.
Yeah, I know, me too. Okay, we're going to wrap this up. We're annoying. Please come to Victory Square Block Party this Sunday, Victory Square. We're going to be giving out, we're actually going to be there. The team, CHS team will be there. So
yeah.
It'd be pretty cool to meet us.
All the silky voices you hear on the radio, you get to meet them in real life, you know?
Indeed. Yeah. Indeed. And we have buttons, so we'll be giving out exclusive
lot of
buttons.
Swag.
They have some, like, glittery tape on, like, in them, so they're great. They're really unique.
Awesome.
Thanks for tuning in to Democracy Watch.
Thank you for tuning in.
CITR 101.9 FM.
Have a great evening.